Good evening. Welcome to the Solera Report. Today is October 27, 2016. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. This is the last piece of the third quarter wrap-up, our primary theme, Investment Screening, Can We Filter for Productive Companies? We'll publish this on October 28th, and we should have the web presentation up by Monday, and of course we'll have the PDF and flipbook in the weeks ahead. So there are going to be a lot of links in the web presentation that you might find very useful. So if you're listening to this by Halloween 2016 or afterwards, I would encourage you to go to the web presentation and check them out. I once had a partner, Dylan Reed, who used to say, the ducks are squawking, I must feed them. And the reason for my wanting to address screening in the third quarter is for many years I've got requests from subscribers and clients and colleagues to do a screen based on the Solera model. And I finally begun to work on it during 2016 and am now convinced that it would be a good thing for me to do, and we plan to offer it in partnership with an investment advisor in 2017. So I wanted to take this opportunity to go back and revisit the current status of the screening industry and get a sense for what's been happening and where the Solera screen's place will be in it. I also felt, given my experience with looking at the screened universe, that it was important that the Solera Report subscribers have a map of this part of the investment universe that helps them navigate it if they should so choose. A couple of the reasons to do a Solera screen, which is going to be a little bit unique even for a very crowded field, is that I think the key to doing successful screening is really of the kind that I'm talking about, really depends on having a very deep and transparent view of the economy. And if you look at the work we do with covert cash flows and the black budget and the sort of machinations of the deeper state, including the shift of G7 capital to the financial coup d'etat, a lot of other investment folks don't take that into account, don't have that background, don't know how to do it. It's made more complicated by the fact that we're going through a remarkable shift as a result of new technology and globalization. I sometimes refer to it as the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0. And so that adds another layer of complexity to the question of if a company is productive and is going to be productive in the future, given the changes underway. And finally, a big one is the end of the debt finance growth model. There are an awful lot of companies that depend on significant growth in government debt. And if you look at the economics of that, that is coming. If it's not coming to an end, the growth is certainly over. Solera screen allows me to integrate these factors into an analysis of individual companies and do it ideally in a manner that it's easy for a busy investment advisor who's focused on picking stocks and the timing of buys and sells can simply work from a list of pre-approved stocks, and they don't have to worry about any of these issues. They just need to pull from the list that has been pre-screened by Solera. And that allows them to look at the things that are critical to producing investment performance, which is something a screen in of itself does not do. Anyway, before I finalized my efforts, I wanted to sort of take a look at the industry and where we were. And so this is an opportunity for me to do that and share my thoughts with you. You all know that I love the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And it sounds great, of course, but when you're operating in highly centralized systems that lack financial transparency, it falls down because we're all busy making money and financing genocide and inhuman treatment of each other. It reminds me of the, I used to work with an investment house in London where the leader would quip a quote from the Roman Emperor Vespasian when he would quote his comment about Roman urine tax, that money has no smell. I looked back to sort of the history of socially responsible investment, and I noticed that the sort of early years of it in the United States harken back to John Wesley, who was one of the founders of the Methodist Church, who sermonized in 1744 on the use of money. But oddly enough, it also dates back to the Quaker Philadelphia yearly meeting, which I used to attend, believe it or not. My ancestors probably being among this group, who banned the financing of slavery in 1758. And so we've been grappling as a society with the financial appendage to the Golden Rule. Finance unto others as you would have them finance unto you. If you're going to make the Golden Rule work globally, you've got to have that financial appendage. And that's part of what screening of the kind that I'm working on is designed to do. At the same time, despite the growth of all these techniques, including socially responsible investment, as invasive technology is leading us into a culture which feels progressively more inhuman, it makes me feel all the more the sense of urgency to figure out a way to get that financial appendage attached to the Golden Rule. So let's talk about screening. What is screening? In the broadest sense, all investments or almost all investments are essentially screened. The major screens include investment characteristics or industry sectors or location. So for example, a mutual fund, an ETF, or an individual portfolio typically is screened for one or more investment characteristics. So it could be the type of asset, real estate or commodities or securities. It could be whether it's liquid or not. So liquid is tradable securities. Illiquid would mean private equity or venture capital or restricted stocks. It could be the type of security. So you have a stock fund or a bond fund. The income profile. So let's say on a stock fund, it could be dividend stocks versus growth stocks, or it could be taxation status, tax-exempt bonds versus taxable. And then, of course, we see a lot done around the size of a company market value. So large cap stocks, medium cap stocks, small cap stocks. Another form, in addition to investment characteristics, is industry sector. And so I listed, in fact, in the web presentation, one of the most common ways of classifying sectors is the Morningstar Global Equity Classification Structure, which defines sectors in 11 different areas. So to give you some examples, I'll just read them quickly. Basic materials, consumer cyclical, financial services, real estate, consumer defensive, healthcare, utilities, communications, energy, industrials, technology. And now finally, as the securities markets have grown globally, we see screens organized around place. So you can buy a mutual fund or an ETF that's focused in North America or Asia, or Latin America, or regions such as Middle East plus Africa, or countries like US domestic, China, et cetera, or areas of economic development, e.g. the emerging markets. I expect as the global liquid markets grow, this is going to permit more investors to essentially trade places. And that means you can align your portfolio with regional growth rates or the geographic contribution to global GNP. Now, let's get to the screens that involve the wider impact of a company's impact on society and the environment, as opposed to just return to shareholders as the sole financial criteria for performance. These are often referred to as ESG screens, ESG standing for environmental, social, and corporate governance. And I've given you on the web presentation a series of links. Sometimes socially responsible will include what is often referred to as morally responsible investment, which is reflects religious groups, particularly Christian and Islamic finance. So there's both socially responsible, and then there's a whole world of different sort of religious approaches. If you take a deep dive into ESG criteria, what you do is you land into a world of highly complex opinions regarding what is moral and what is responsible and what an individual company can do about it. The variety is very, very wide. Many of these opinions are sincere, but unfortunately, a lot of them depend on a world where the real transparency around the economy is quite limited, and they're very serious material emissions. If you're a subscriber to the Salary Report, you already know that. Some of the opinions are motivated by what I would call soft revolution politics, which is really using human criteria to stalk for inhuman purposes and sort of political and strategic advantage. So, you know, whether people are struggling with an absence of transparency leading to sort of opinions that are out of sorts with what I believe are the real facts, or people who have other agendas other than really getting to responsible investment, you can run into a very mixed bag and a wide variety of stuff. There are numerous strategies used to apply ESG criteria, but let me just describe the main ones. First is positive screens. Those are screens which seek out companies that achieve positive results according to specified criteria. And so that would include clean energy, a clean energy fund, or a women-friendly fund. Then you have negative screens, which are much more likely and predominant in terms of asset, number of assets under management, are designed to filter out what I would call the bad dogs. So anything goes as long as it's not one of the designated stinkers. Traditionally, that has included makers of weapons, alcohol, or tobacco. Then you have shareholder activism, which can be combined with either a positive or negative screen for maximum effect. And that involves an investor using their shareholder status through the proxy, annual voting process, or other avenues to influence the company and shareholders to lobby for policies. A lot of time, that's lobbying for policies in areas of best practices in government or employee compensation. And so there's a wide range of activism by shareholders, some of which is just financial, some of which involves ESG. Then finally, there's targeted investment, which tends to be the illiquid investment where you're targeting specific needs. That includes economically targeted investment, community investment, something that's now called impact investing. And that tends to be a smaller volume, highly targeted area. A lot of times, or increasingly, I see the word sustainable applied to the entire ESG related investment area. And I'm not quite sure how to explain a working definition of sustainable. I think the idea is to mean that the impact on the whole is positive. Otherwise, the system, if everybody has a negative impact on the whole, the system can't last. But sustainable gets to be a very muddy, murky word in a world where you don't have sufficient transparency about the governance systems and the governmental and tax-exempt resources, not to mention the nature of invisible technology and weaponry that seems to be driving a lot of things in and around the planet. So I tend not to use the word sustainable because I struggle with what it really means. So let's look at the size of the universe of investment that uses some form of ESG screening or criteria. There have been two recent studies that have made a serious attempt to define the size of the ESG universe. The first is the 2014 Global Sustainable Investment Review, which I linked to on the web presentation, and then a report by the U.S. group involved in the Global Sustainable Investment Review called the Report on U.S. Sustainable, Responsible, and Impact Investing Trends 2014. And that's the Forum for Sustainable and Responsible Investment and the U.S. SIF Foundation. The global study was done with representatives from Europe, Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the Forum, as I said, in the United States. What they found was in the global study that the universe of assets that are subject to ESG criteria of some kind rose from $13.3 trillion in 2012 to $21.4 trillion at the start of 2014. That's pretty significant growth. By their classification system, that means that 30% of professionally managed assets in the regions covered are related to ESG. That is a fairly sizable percentage on a historical basis. So it has clearly become fairly fashionable to include some form of ESG criteria. If you break down the numbers, Europe is clearly the leader in incorporating ESG criteria. The predominant strategies are negative screening and integration of some of the ESG criteria into traditional analysis, which I suspect is pretty much integrating best business practices and governance, and a fairly classic kind of underwriting. So I think if you look at the numbers between the negative screening and the integration of criteria into traditional analysis, I think it's probably pretty light and not what most people would consider socially what has been classically socially responsible investment. On the US side, the universe is now about $7 trillion as of 2014. But I should note, and the growth has been pretty significant, but I should note that the same group now is planning on publishing their report on US Sustainable, Responsible, and Impact Investing Trends 2016 in mid-November 2016. So we're just about to get an update, and it will be interesting to see if this kind of growth is continued. So let's talk about the deeper issues. One of the challenges faced by investors interested in applying ESG criteria is that they run the risk of fighting the model. If you look at the current economic model on planet Earth, we have what I call the central banking warfare model. Essentially, the central banks print money and the military makes sure that most people take them in exchange for cheap natural resources. And what we see is the economics around a lot of things and the sort of winners and losers in a marketplace around a lot of things are really driven by central banking monetary policy and government fiscal and other policies. And it reflects a model that really does run things to ensure the tight central control of a relatively small group of invisible players who don't operate necessarily under the laws as we believe them to be. They seem to operate with a fair amount of immunity from the law, and their criteria is not necessarily to make everything work. It's to make sure everything works with, for them with low risk. So it's a very different model than what you get in economics class or business school. And the danger, of course, is that when you are doing something like socially responsible investment, without clear transparency on the governance system and what's really going on, that you can end up running the risk of bucking the flow or being marginalized on the sort of edges of things. One of my favorite quotes is from Reg Howe's excellent opening to his famous essay, The Golden Sextant, where he describes the harm done to the economy by fiat currency and the importance of sound money if you're going to have a healthy culture and a healthy economy. He opens it up as follows. He says, "A recent book entitled Good Money Towns, SRI, Socially Responsible Investing, or How to Do Good Socially While Doing Well Financially, but whatever the legal currency, dollars, marks, yens, franc, or pounds, in which practitioners of SRI make their investments, they cannot make bad money good. SRI cannot repeal Gresham's Law. Properly understood, good money is good, not because of the motives of its owners, but because of its own intrinsic character. Truly, good money will produce far more social benefits than any amount of bad money spent with good intentions." I couldn't agree more. A lot of the problems that we have is a result of the absence of sound money and the current central banking, very liberal fiat currency and monetary policy. Another one of my favorite quotes from the same group is from GATA Treasurer Chris Pelley. Said, "Fiat currency has done far more environmental damage than all the mining companies have ever dreamt of doing." And I think that's true. Fiat currency has been devastating for the environment and very much a contributor to an economic model that is oblivious to what its long-term impact is on the environment, which I don't think would happen if you had sound money and if you allowed equity to flow by place. Anyway, in this environment, real change requires addressing the core system issues at the root, which is the fundamental government structure, the central bank policies, the government policies, including credit spending regulation enforcement, and the actual policies related to transparency of taxpayer resources, respect for individual privacy, and fairness in the application of the law. All of these are sort of hacking at the root instead of at the branches. And if you're not hacking at the root, but instead doing SRI without also, you know, bringing transparency to those things and dealing with them, then you're going to end up fairly marginalized. One of the reasons that I feel very comfortable about developing the Solari screen is that I'm going to continue to bring transparency to the deepest issues through the Solari report, and so the two efforts reinforce each other and help to keep each other honest. Real transparency is so important. I keep underscoring Robert Axelrod's great book, The Evolution of Cooperation, where he makes clear how much market incentive there is for individuals and institutions to shun criminal players if they can see them clearly. But in our world, you can't see clearly who's doing what, not to mention what's happening with entrainment and mind control technology. And so I need to underscore again and again, if we're going to append a financial rule to the golden rule, we absolutely must have transparency about how the economy works and who's doing what. So I want to go back in history and talk a little bit about some of my history trying to understand the application of ESG criteria and the nature of socially responsible investment. When I left the Bush administration and started Hamilton Securities Group in 1991, I was absolutely convinced that new technology could make an extraordinary impact on the circulation of equity capital, and it would be possible to finance many places with private equity rather than government investment. We could literally back out a lot of government investment and bring in private equity into the equivalent of a county or municipality. Part of the challenge of doing that was I needed to understand how digital and information technology would positively impact or could positively impact the daily economics of a family, a business, and a municipality. So we started to build databases of government and mortgage credit investment by place, as well as software tools that would help us analyze public and private investment within a county or community level, and then simulate opportunities to improve the related performance of both taxpayer and private investment returns. And during that period, we ended up also entering into a joint venture with the U.S. Department of Labor. They paid for a portion, we paid for a portion, to take a look at how pension funds were incorporating ESG criteria, including economically targeted investments. And that joint venture came with an advisory board of top state, corporate, and union pension leaders. One of our goals was to help them understand and make recommendations to the Department of Labor regarding policies related to ETIs. The more we listened to them, the more we got to focus on their needs to make sure they achieve the retirements for the baby boomer generation, particularly in light of what was happening with globalization underway. One of our conclusions after building those databases and looking at what was happening was that government policies needed to change if communities were going to be successful. In fact, if you did change them, there was an extraordinary opportunity, particularly for the pension funds. But if you weren't going to change them, then ETIs was or economically targeted investments would simply make matters worse. If government policies are making sure that a community is failing, then bringing in pension funds to also lose money on top of that is only going to make matters worse. So if you're going to destroy a local economy, the last thing you need to do is also destroy additional retirement savings with it, even if it creates a few photo ops for a couple of politicians. It's just more waste. It's more bad money after bad money. And so we came out quite negatives on ETIs, and I publish in the web presentation an article I wrote afterwards describing it and why we thought ETIs were, hacking at the symptoms that was bad for investors. And because the last thing, the most socially responsible thing we can do for any institution or any person is make sure they get they get optimal returns on their investment. Socially responsible is making sure the pension funds can meet their obligations to their retirees. I later described our final report to that group of pension fund investors in my online book, Dylan Reed and Company in the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, and that includes the story where the president of CalPERS had told me it was too late to re-engineer government investment in America. They'd given up on the country and were moving all the money starting out in the fall, and that's when the missing money, now up to $20 trillion, is missing from the U.S. government. And that raises a further question, which is, if a pension fund such as CalPERS, one of the largest in the world, that's the California Public Employees Pension Fund, knew and understood that the housing bubble was fraudulent, there was a financial coup underway, but they kept buying U.S. mortgage securities, which they did in great size during that period. What that meant is central control mechanisms could override fiduciary law on this kind of scale. And the question is, if that's going on, how in the world is socially responsible investment going to make a difference? Again, you're going to have to go at these issues, and this is the governance issue at the root. Obviously, as described in the Dylan Reed story, Hamilton then was closed, and as a result of a lengthy period of litigation with the federal government, we were being very successful in terms of allowing private equity to come into communities, which the federal government made clear they didn't want. I describe in the earlier quote a story of related to that. Let me just go back and read it to you. Finally, ETIs are often used as a way of shutting off capital to local players. In 1999, I had lunch with the general counsel to the chairman of an important congressional committee overseeing community development. He told me in no uncertain terms that my ideas for providing small business access to equity capital would not be permitted. In fact, the only capital that would be allowed to flow into minority communities would go through national not-for-profit tax shelter pools. This meant that small business people would be shut off from access to credit while do-gooders were helping the neighborhood would be granted a monopoly position. I should note that these investments were then later marketed to SRI funds. So it's a pretty ugly picture of what is supposed to be a socially responsible investment implementing essentially capital controls that deny sort of market access to capital in African-American neighborhoods. It was a very ugly picture. Anyway, so during the litigation, I was invited by one of the leaders in the social responsible investment community to speak at one of their annual conferences. And so I got an opportunity to kind of dip in for a short while into that industry. When I walked into the conference, this was probably in 1998 or 99, all the sponsors had big banners around the top of the, close to the ceiling, around the whole huge convention hall. And they were literally every one of the companies, the big financial institutions that I associated with engineering the housing bubble and related mortgage fraud, as well as laundering narcotics trafficking revenues. I felt like I was in a hall of criminals. I tried to talk to the various SRI industry representatives and leaderships there, and it was clear that they were entirely uncomfortable discussing any of this, being that it was the criminals that was financing their efforts. And I left that conference with the clear impression that the goal of SRI investing was to affirm the overt leadership of the people and institutions running the covert economy on a highly profitable basis. So the criminals had found a socially committed marketing way of marketing their stocks while avoiding any interference with their real power lines. That was enough to send me far, far away from the socially responsible investment community. It got worse when I discovered that one of the leaders of the LBO industry, who's described in my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, was financing an effort to promote B corporations, which is an idea of coming up with a corporate structure that means that the honest people take on far more liability and complexity, which I think is the last thing they need. I think we need to We need to remove the advantages from the criminal players and make life easier for the lawful players. But there is a between increased government regulation and legislation and these kind of things like B Corp, it's going the other way. It's dumping more and more requirements and liabilities on the lawful players. At some point, my frustration knew no bounds. So in 2005, I decided to share some of my thoughts on SRI investing in a Solari audio seminar. Beyond socially responsible investing, is SRI hazardous to your health? And I go through some of these issues. I put the link in the web presentation, but if you go to the library, your resource page, the bottom of the page, you can also find the access to all the Solari audio seminars, which you have as part of your archive. Okay, moving on in history, let's talk about reviewing SRI mutual funds and ETFs. After I finished the litigations and became an investment advisor, my next encounter with SRI investing was reviewing mutual funds and ETFs owned by my investment advisory clients. A client would come and they'd have it in their portfolio. So I'd go in to take a look at it. And then I would bump into various approaches by pension funds and sovereign wealth funds, both through the investment advisory work and things that would come up, particularly market reviews for the Solari report. And what I found was there was a very wide variety from funds doing extraordinary things. I put a link up, for example, to the information at Wikipedia about the Norwegian sovereign wealth funds, which are quite fascinating in terms of what they sort of their history of grappling with socially responsible issues and ESG criteria. I also saw a lot of irresponsibility that I thought was part of the soft revolution tactics that we discuss and follow regularly on the Solari report. If you haven't listened to my interview with Nafeez Ahmed or with Wayne Mattson on soft revolution, you can find more there. Anyway, during the 2008-2009 financial crisis, I'll never forget this. I was reviewing a mutual fund in an SRI company prospectus, and a lot of times a mutual fund company will have one prospectus covering a multitude of funds. And the funds I was looking at was next to a fund that was designed to invest in companies that were good to women. And that was the basic fundamental screen of the company. They only invested in companies that were great for women. And I couldn't believe my eyes. In the top 10 holdings, if you would ask me to make a list of the candidates of the companies that were the worst for women or human, the same thing, many of them would have turned out were in those top 10 holdings. So the companies they were defining as the 10 best for women were on my list of the 10 most harmful for women. So I dug in to see how in the world that could happen. And of course, one of the ways it happens is they're basing their analysis on what the company says it does as opposed to what the company is really up to. Then the second thing is they're basing it on sort of process that any company can put into place in terms of expensive personnel policies. And sort of that's in my the web presentation of hiring a bunch of people, a bunch of women and minorities from Harvard Business School and starting a lending program for women-owned businesses and thinking that that counts when, in fact, you're responsible for hundreds of thousands of foreclosures all over the country resulting from financial entrapment. So anybody who's listened to our interview with Helen Shapeman on JP Morgan or looked at their Helen's website that lists all the fines for criminal activities of JP Morgan would be amazed when I say that JP Morgan was one of the largest holdings in this fund that was supposed to be great for women. Anyway, so it was clear that the interest in ESG governance was growing, and ESG application of ESG criteria, but is a very, very wide tent in terms of how it's applied, and again, whether it's hacking at the branches or at the root of the issues. Clearly, a decision has been made for corporations to rule a much greater percentage of the world's assets and operations. So that means that more and more people have a vested interest in having them do wisely. So I think the application of ESG is going to continue to grow. But if you look at where we are in terms of real performance and results, clearly we have a long way to go. Okay, so let me talk about the Solieri model. What happened after all of our work with place-based databases and the pension fund databases at Hamilton is I came to the conclusion that the ideal approach to essentially append the financial aspect to the golden rule was pretty simple. Think of it this way. A company has an impact on its economic ecosystem. So I'll call that the total economic return. And it can be positive or negative. You know, the world can be better off for the company's existence. It can be worse off. And it translates its the value that it creates in the ecosystem to a flow of revenues and profits that produce a return to shareholders. And of course, that return to shareholders can be positive and negative. We always are looking for one that's positive. The difference between the total economic return and the return to shareholders. So the company creates value, the shareholders get a piece of it. That which remains, I call the return to the network. So think of it this way, the total economic return equals the return to the network plus the return to the shareholders. So you create value in the world and the shareholders get a piece of it and the world gets a piece of it. So clearly this framework is conceptual. We can measure the return to shareholders because there's profits that come in the door and dividends that get paid. It's much harder to measure total economic return and return to the network, particularly given, as I said, all the absence of transparency and secrecy we're dealing with in the general economy. The goal to me of a company governance and management should be to achieve excellence at the company's strategic goal, which is making cars or sailing ships or operating trains or growing food, whatever it is the company does. But it wants to do that in a manner that optimizes long-term shareholder value. So I agree with this traditional view. Companies are focused entities. They can't be all things to all people. And so their goal needs to be to optimize, to do an excellent job at what it is their mission is to do and do it in a way that optimizes their shareholder value. And I absolutely concur with that. But I also believe that companies and investors need to take the time to understand their total economic return, both as a vehicle to understanding potential for opportunities and improving risk management. And the faster and more change we have in the world, the more important it is to do this, to use your total economic return as a navigating tool for understanding how to evolve what you do and how you do it. I've added one constraint, though, from the traditional model. I think it is essential that a company never intentionally engage in activities that have a negative return to the network. Doesn't mean they never have a negative return to the network, because it's impossible to be right. You make mistakes, things go wrong. But what I'm saying is you don't adopt a model which is specifically designed to hurt the network. So grossly oversimplified, what the Solieri model says is make money by adding value. Don't adopt a business model that makes money shrinking the pie. It's one of my colleagues always says, are we going to bake pies or steal each other's pies? Another way of saying it, is don't engage in organized crime and activities that diminish human productivity broadly. The notion of looking at total economic return was something that made sense for large pension fund investors who were increasingly making investments in one part of their portfolio that conflicted with the assumptions embedded in investments in other parts of their portfolio. As we were centralizing wealth in the 90s, you could see American money was increasingly taking on what I would call the multiple personality disorder that you saw in the geopolitics and in the culture. So as an example, I want to read you my letter to the New York Times in 1999 regarding private prison companies. So this letter was written on March 7th, 1999 to the New York Times. It's in fact up on my website. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for Tim Egan's article on prisons. It was an excellent summary of the growth in the U.S. prison population over the last two decades. A welcome follow-up might be an exploration on how the money works on prisons. The federal government has promoted mandatory sentences and taken other steps that will increase the overall prison population to approximately 3 million Americans as recently legislated policies finish working their way through the sentencing system. This means that approximately 10 to 15 million Americans will be under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system, from arrest to indictment to trial to prison to probation and parole. The enactment of legislation ensuring the growth of prisons and prison populations has been a bipartisan effort. Republicans and Democrats alike appear to have found one area where we can build consensus for substantial growth in government budgets, staffing levels, and media attention. Indeed, during this period, the number of federal agencies with police powers has grown to over 50, approximately 10% of the American enforcement bureaucracy. This is further encouraged by federal laws permitting confiscation of assets such as homes, cars, bank accounts, cash, businesses, and personal property that can be used to fund federal, state, and local enforcement budgets. One way to look at the financial issues involved is to view them from the vantage point of the portfolio strategists of the large mutual funds. We have approximately 250 to 280 million people in America. The question from a portfolio strategist standpoint is, what productive value will each one be creating in companies and communities, and how does that translate into flow of funds that then translate into equity values and bond risk? The prison companies are marketing one vision of America with their prison and prisoner growth rates, while the consumer companies are marketing another's. The two are not compatible. CCA's assumptions, CCA is one of the largest prison companies, private prison companies, regarding the growth in arrests and incarcerations cannot be true of Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac, and Sally Mae's assumption about home ownership and college education rates are. We the people cannot refinance our mortgages or buy homes or raise our children and send them to college if we are in prison. Meantime, the municipal debt market is also facing conflicting positions. If prison bonds are a good investment, then some general obligation bonds may be in trouble. We, the taxpayers, cannot support the debt. We are no longer taxpayers. We have become prisoners. Whatever we are generating in prison labor, it is certainly not enough to pay the $154,000 per person per year cost indicated for the full system by the General Accounting Office. It would be very illuminating to get the rating agencies and the 10 largest mutual funds together in one room for an investor roundtable to discuss pricing issues on the investment over savings that is internal to their portfolios and ratings. We would compare equity valuation and growth rates of companies who make money from the American people losing productivity, companies who make money from helping the American people grow more knowledgeable and productive. We are investing in two different visions that cannot both come true. We could then calculate what was going to succeed and what the integrated pricing level would be. Better yet, what could happen that would make the most money for the investment community? The question is, which vision is best for we, the equity investors of America? And why are investors assuming both can or will as they price their stocks and bonds? It's critical to look at prison policy from the standpoint of maximizing return on equity investment. It would be a terrible thing, while I can no longer pay taxes or buy a house or send to college because I'm in prison, if my vested pension benefits were wiped out by the time I re-entered society. It's bad enough that my life savings are being invested in companies that make money from promoting that my family and me should be arrested and incarcerated. It would be worse if my family and I were broke because companies that make money from loss of productivity turned out to be also a bad investment. Such a roundtable might make for a great New York Times article. If you're willing to take it on, Solari would be happy to assist your staff by contributing background analytics on how the money works in prison. Sincerely yours, Catherine Austin Fitz, President, Solari, Inc. Needless to say, the New York Times did not publish this and did not respond, and it was all part of me learning that I had to start publishing my opinions on my own website, leading ultimately to the creation of the Solari Report. So thank you, New York Times, for all your shenanigans, because now you've put me in the media business. Anyway, 17 years later, on August 2006, after the Department of Justice announced that it was not going to renew Bureau of Prison contracts with private prison companies, the stocks of the two largest prison companies dropped almost 50% the first hour of trading. To be honest, I should also note that in 2008, the stocks of Freddie and Fannie dropped to essentially nothing. And so the multiple personality disorder and the fraud behind it wiped out a lot of investors on both sides of the equation. Anyway, the private prison companies is one of the many examples of companies that are dependent on government funding that is running at an expense level which is significantly above the most economic ways to provide that function. Essentially, as I describe in my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, there are two prison systems involved, one for the people incarcerated and one for the taxpayers required to fund the first. So with the debt finance growth model over, these kinds of things can't keep going on. We can't afford an absence of productivity. We also can't afford for the country to be run by people who are used to free printing presses for printing money. That's no longer going to work. So this is going to be an interesting thing. And one of the things I'm very interested in screening for is screening for companies that can't jump the curve on the end of the debt finance growth model. Investment screening. Can we filter for productive companies? So that's the question. Can we filter for productive companies? My answer is most certainly yes. The truth is it's an art, not a science. The first reason it's an art, not a science is given the absence of transparency about how the global governance and financial system work, I have to do a lot of guessing to guess what's really going on with the covert cash flows and assets, and then how different companies are involved. We know that trillions are missing in the global financial coup d'etat, but we don't know where that money is and how it will be reinvested. Of course, again, I can guess, but the reality is that with the kind of absence of transparency that we have and the secrets that we have, there's a lot of guesswork and there are going to be surprises and I'm not always going to be right. The second problem is that I can be confident that a company's products and services are highly productive and they make money for shareholders, add value to the general economy. However, such a company can be targeted for economic warfare by the government, example, some of the coal companies, or by covert operations like Chipotle, and in a manner that significantly harms or destroys the company. So productivity is not necessarily a panacea protection against growing political risks, particularly from the unproductive. Third, for the Solari screen, I'm focused on significant fundamental business quality. I'm looking for companies that make money in the marketplace, and I'm concerned about several things. Let me describe them. The first thing I look at when I look at a company is I look at who owns them, who's on the board of directors, who governs, and who the managers are. I want to know who. The financials are nowhere near the priority that I give to the quality and the nature of the people. I'm looking for companies whose investors, whose directors and managers reflect the experience, the knowledge, and the personal human networks required by that particular business, by the nature of their employees, their customers, the constituencies and markets that they serve. So I'm looking at a knowledge management and human contact management and expertise sort of living flow within the company and its culture. So critical is that the leadership can produce excellence at their core mission. And ideally they have a deep bench. So excellence in governance and management is always number one. Lawfulness. I'm looking for companies with a fundamental business model that is lawful. It doesn't mean they're perfect. As I said, it doesn't mean they don't make mistakes. It doesn't mean a duly authorized officer of the corporation doesn't try and cut corners or break the law, but it does mean that the company has not adopted a model where it is institutionally and intentionally criminal or unlawful, which unfortunately more and more we see. Risk issues. I'm looking to avoid what I call real stinkers. They may play by the letter of law, but they have a reputation for playing dirty or working overtime to make highly questionable or highly unethical practices technically legal. And these are folks that are likely to get caught eventually by consumer or investor blowback. Monsanto is a recent case in point. And then finally, I'm looking for folks who are private. I prefer companies that make money in private markets as opposed to depend on a high degree of government purchases or contracts like the private prison companies. that in this environment can come with a heavy degree of political risk. The exception to that is you'll see state-owned companies in the international markets where this is a common seasoned practice, and in fact, a hybrid public-private partnership can reduce political risk. So embedded in all of this is, of course, given the changes and the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0, I'm looking at companies who can jump the curve in the changes that are upon us. Now, by definition, this means that a Solari screen will leave out a significant number of ESG criteria. If you look at the list of what many people apply, it's very long. I consider this a positive screen. I'm looking for companies with high productivity that contribute to the productivity of the general population and do so in a manner that supports enduring performance for shareholder in the current environment and the environment ahead. Now, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, that's great, Catherine, but how do you define real stinkers? If you're screening out, yes, it's a positive screen, but it means, of course, we're screening out real stinkers. A company that's a real stinker, I think, fits Justice Potter Stewart's characterization of pornography. I know it when I see it. There is a wide variation on ESG criteria. So I thought I would provide for you a description of the kinds of companies that I would say are real stinkers that generate a negative return to the network as sort of a function of their model. Several months ago, I asked Jason Worth, who's been doing some great book reviews for us over the last year, to help me compile a list of examples of companies with business models that intentionally are designed to profit from a negative return to to the network. And so I included that in your web presentation to give you a sense of this. And also because it's a work in progress, I'd love your input. If you have comments on it, please definitely send or post on the website under subscriber comments. Anyway, but it'll give you a flavor. And one of the things you'll see a lot of in the consumer section are companies that use entrainment and subliminal programming and other forms of mind control to encourage the population to overspend, overconsume, overborrow, and adopt all sorts of different addictions, which I think is a very significant and growing problem that we're going to be talking a lot about in 2017. I think you can guess what some of these look like. I'll just read you a couple. There's so many. I've got social media firms that spy on the web surfing activity and email content of their users, sell data about their users' activities and behaviors to third parties, or otherwise compromise security, provide government agencies with data on users with legitimate court orders. We've got financial institutions that engage in predatory lending, particularly on student loans, that launder narcotics trafficking and other illegal forms, engage in mortgage fraud, on and on and on. A lot of references to covert and black budget kind of operations. Anyway, I would encourage you to take a look at that list and send in your thoughts and comments. Unfortunately, what's interesting about this list is that I end up screening a lot of companies that are the darlings of SRI investment and don't screen out companies that a lot of people disqualify. So I'm not screening out gun manufacturers. I'm not screening out tobacco companies. I'm not screening out alcohol producers. If you don't want to drink liquor, just don't buy it and drink it. I feel a little bit differently about something like alcohol. I think anybody who grows up in our society knows what the risks, the pros and cons of alcohol are. What concerns me is when we see things like digital slot machines, which are really created and marketed with entrainment technology. And that is, there's not full and fair disclosure to the consumer about what's really involved. And that's sort of one of my beefs with entrainment is you don't have proper full and fair disclosure. I come from an industry where if you don't have proper full and fair dis- disclosure, that's considered a criminal violation. So I see a lot of the marketing with these kinds of invisible technologies to be deeply offensive, whereas a gun manufacturer, a tobacco company, an alcohol producer, I'm a bit of a libertarian. If you don't want it, don't buy it. Okay, so you come out with a very, very different screen if you take a look at those sort of what qualifies as a stinker in the Soleri screen. You come out with a very different sort than you'll see in the popular SRI fund. So we will be entirely unique, is my expectation, within the world of ESG screening. So in conclusion, as I review the world of ESG criteria and its application to investment management, I'm reminded of a title by one of my favorite essayists, Michael Ventura, that he did with James Hillman called, "We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse." We've had many decades of incredible effort by ESG activists and leaders trying to really inform using investment to append the financial part to the golden rule. Unfortunately, at the same time, we've had a rush of globalization, which has contributed to a lack of accountability and all sorts of cross-border freedom for a wide range of corporate shenanigans. If you add to that invasive and invisible technology and weaponry, it seems as though the evildoers are gaining on us. At the same time, I absolutely believe that a combination of serious transparency and broad-based application of the golden rule to finance and investment can make an enormous difference. It's one of the few things that I think can make an enormous difference. As I say always during any presidential campaign, we vote at the polls every 1, 2, or 4 years, but we vote every day in the marketplace and in the world with our time, our attention, and our money, and that's what really counts. If you look at how centralized the government, particularly the U.S. federal bureaucracy, is, I don't expect to see a lot happen, no matter who wins this presidency or any presidency. If you've listened to a lot of the Soleri Report, you know that this is a much deeper and more broad-based problem, and the question is, how can we shift the balance of power and do it in a way without physical and forceful and very dangerous confrontation? And shifting our time, our attention, money is arguably the most powerful and effective and enduring way. Anyway, we've had the benefit, as I said, of decades of hard work by committed proponents of SRI, and especially good corporate governance and business practices from which we can draw. And despite the occasional mess by this soft revolution spinmeisters, I have a lot of hope that the application of ES criteria on an economic basis, now that it's considered socially acceptable, even fashionable to do, can make an important contribution, especially if we have honest media helping us do it. So I'm a believer, but as you can hear from my history with this stuff, I'm a very discerning one. So I hope if you are a creator or consumer of ESG-related services, such as socially responsible investment, I hope this Soleri Report will inspire you to be a discerning one too. This is one that we need to get right. If we just allow it to be packaging for evildoers, it just... a whole lot of time and attention and work by a lot of great SRI and corporate governance proponents will go down the drain. So your discernment is called for and deeply appreciated. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, investment screening, can we filter for productive companies? The answer is absolutely yes, but it's going to be an art and not a science. And it's going to be a difficult organic road, but one I look forward to. So I would encourage you again to check out the web presentation. We'll have it up by Halloween, and there are a lot of good links to studies and other information which you can explore if this is an area of interest with you. And so with that, let me just remind you that never ask whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.